You're very welcome. My name is Una Frawley. On behalf of my co-organisers, Emily Mark Fitzgerald and Marguerite Corporal, you're very welcome to Maynooth University and to the Great Famine and its impacts. This conference is convened here at Maynooth University in association with the International Network of Irish Famine Studies based at Radboud University in the Netherlands. And we're really honoured to be holding this conference here today and delighted that so many of you have been able to join us from so far afield, whether flying in all the way from Japan, from Finland, from the UK, and the South Campus, just across the road. The diverse range of speakers and disciplines represented here speaks to the continuing impact of the famine on culture, broadly conceived, and we really look forward to an exciting few days together. I'd like to acknowledge the generous financial support of the English department here at the university, as well as the research office, and of course the Dutch Research Council, which funded Marguerite's network, which she'll speak to you about. So thank you, and you're all very welcome. Marguerite.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Una, for opening the conference. And I would like to start by not only welcoming you all and being delighted at seeing so many of you gathered here, but also to tell you a little bit more about the network that you've probably wondered about ever since you saw the call coming up. It's officially called the International Network of Irish Famine Studies. And as Una was saying, we are officially based at Radboud University in Nijmegen, the Netherlands. And actually, the beginning of that whole project was December 2012, when a group of people, many of whom are also gathered here in the room, and actually also including our first speaker, Jason King, came to Nijmegen to exchange ideas about how to be able to further the course of Irish famine studies and whether there would be possibilities for joint funding applications and also for, for basically a collaborative kind of effort that would give a sort of push into new directions. Now, what came out of that was the application to the Dutch Research Council to set up this international network. And the network was officially, basically starting in 2014 with another meeting in 2013 in the Interfor, actually in Belfast, organised by Peter Gray. But 2014 was the official start of the network under the NWO funding. And it's very interesting because we work with many people. Actually, many people are involved from many different countries. We actually extend our network to Brazil, to Canada, to the United States. So I'm actually very delighted that also today we have many people here from many different parts of the world, even including Japan. So we're gathered here in a very transnational community, which is also what we would really like to see with the network. Now, the network is organising a series of expert meetings and conferences. And so far, we've had the pleasure of actually already hosting two main events. And one was a conference on migration in Nijmegen, which was held in April last year. And the second meeting was organised by Andy Newby in Helsinki, which was in December, and had to do with comparative famines. And we were actually, at the time, drawing up a sort of an agenda for future directions of famine studies. We really felt that the visual cultures of the famine should also be really high on the list. It's a very underexplored kind of area. And it was Luke Gibbons, who works here at Maynooth University, who came up with actually this suggestion and gave a very enthusiastic lecture about the potential to explore the visual repositories of famine memory. And with him on board, and also with people like Emily, who's also co-organising the conference, we're actually with many people here that actually, we're willing to invest in ideas also of material culture and also other forms of visual art, including drama and film. And of course, you will see all of these elements also featured on the programme for the next few days. So the network is working on basically, you could say, those core challenges of Irish famine studies. And there's going to be another meeting in Belfast next year, organised by Peter Gray, which will be a bit broader, I think, a broader kind of focus, which will have to do probably with, you could say, the globalised context of famine or new directions for famine studies, which will also be open to postgraduates. And because that's also what we really try to do with the network, we try to stimulate new research, not just by senior scholars, but also by lots of junior scholars, and it does also give an impetus to their careers. So we're also happy to see that we have a very mixed group here over the next few days coming together to exchange ideas and research. I think that's a very exciting kind of prospect. Now, I would like to give a very warm welcome not just to all of you sitting here who are going to give a very important contribution to Irish Famine Studies over the next few days, but especially also to all my fellow directors of the network, to Peter, who is sitting here up front, to Andrew Newby from Helsinki, but also to Luke, to Kieran, and to Una from Maynooth University. And I would like to extend my thanks, as Una also did previously, to Maynooth University for the very generous matching funding they've given to the project, for the time investment they have made, and especially the English department and the research school for basically supporting this whole venture. The network cannot exist without many scholars doing all the important work we are doing today. So I'm actually very happy to see you all here. But we also try to basically organise other important events as well. So we also have, are developing, you could say, a database, a digital database, which includes important material that can be used by museums, can be used by universities and other kinds of institutions. And the idea of building up material, like creating a sort of big kind of famine bibliography that is very interdisciplinary, for instance, but also maybe posting course materials that could give people suggestions of how to teach the famine from a wide range of perspectives and also a wide range of disciplines, is becoming, I think, one of the main major aims we also have. We're in the process of working on that right now, and hopefully by the time we are in Belfast, that will be a sort of an up and running and very successful venture of the network as well. Part of what we're going to be recorded on the page of the network is also the podcast that are going to be made of the keynote lectures during these days. There's already quite some interesting material that's going to be posted there. But I would also like to ask you, as a sort of final note before I'm going to introduce the keynote speaker, also to become affiliated members of the network. I hope that the next few days will really give you a great sense of what it means, what it could mean to be part of our network and to contribute, because we could also be building up this whole idea of the network even together. We could actually extend it, and we would also be able to get this digital repository working, I think mainly also with the help of all of you. So I hope it's going to be sort of an invitation or an appetite that's being whetted that will help you to be further involved in the future. I will leave my information about the network on that, if you don't mind, because I would be delighted to introduce our first keynote speaker as well, and that's Dr. Jason King. And Jason King is, I would say, a very well-known scholar in the field of Irish Famine Studies. He's done very important work on the famine diaspora, especially in Canada. He's also the person who has basically made the famine digital archive, which is now, I think, hosted in NUI Galway. And it's very important work because it also involves digitalisation of the Grey Nuns archives. And I think those are very underexplored documentary witness reports about the arrival of famine immigrants in Montreal. So it's a very important thing. He's done lots of important work, as I said, on the famine. He's also done lots of work on drama in relation to migration and the famine. So I would say he's, in a way, doubly invested to speak about this topic of visual cultures of the famine from the perspective of migration, because he's worked on it from the field, basically, of images, text, but also of drama. And he's been an IRC postdoctoral researcher at the Moore Institute of NUI Galway, but has also held positions as a lecturer here at Maynooth, but also at l'Université de Montréal, and Concordia University. I'm just going to mention a few of his important publications, if he doesn't mind. But actually, he published a special issue of the Canadian Journal of Irish Studies on Irish-Canadian connections with Kevin James in 2005, and also special issues of the Irish Review on Memoir, Memory, and Migration in Irish Culture with Tina O'Toole, which was published in 2012. Also, very recently, a special issue of Irish Studies Review on Irish Multiculturalism in Crisis with Pilar Arguais in 2015. And I'm very delighted to say we've also been working together a lot. And we actually co-edited a special issue of Atlantic Studies Global Currents on Irish Global Migration, Transatlantic Perspectives on the Great Irish Famine. I'm also happy to say that that special issue apparently was so successful that it's going to be published in book form and come out with Routledge later this year. So I think this is quite an introduction to what Jason's work is about, and I think we're delighted that he's going to speak to us today on this topic, Feminine Irish Refugee Crisis, Composite Images of Coffin Ships. Jason, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marguerite, for that generous introduction. Thank you to Emily and to Una for organizing this event, and of course to the members of the network and to everyone here at Maynooth University. "No more coffin ships," read a placard at a refugee welcome rally in Dublin last September. The publication of the defining image of the European refugee crisis, the drowned Syrian toddler Alan Kurdi on a Turkish beach, had inspired the rally and prompted immediate comparisons with the famine Irish forced migration of 1847. Quote, "Ireland can cope with more than the refugees already taken in. Ireland will also remember our own migrant history and the coffin ships of the 19th century," declared former Taoiseach, caretaker Taoiseach, Enda Kenny. Quote, "What happened in the era of the coffin ships is what is happening now," claimed Gerry Adams. There can be little doubt that the publication of Kurdi's image had an immediate impact in shaping Irish, European, and North American public opinion. Shortly after Kurdi perished, hundreds gathered at Rowan Gillespie's Famine Memorial in Dublin to express solidarity with refugees. At the same time, Gillespie's Famine Memorial in Ireland Park, Toronto, became the focal point for Canadian reactions to Kurdi's death. These Irish and Canadian responses to the refugee crisis were largely filtered through the cultural memory of the coffin ships. The title of my lecture this morning, as Marguerite mentioned, is Famine Irish Refugee Crisis, Composite Images of Coffin Ships. Broadly speaking, I want to consider the genealogy of this image of the coffin ship and trace its historical moment of origin. More specifically, I want to examine the power of the image to shape public reaction and government policy in response to the Irish famine migration of 1847 and 48. David Wilson has convincingly argued that the phrase coffin ships was first coined by Thomas D'Arcy McGee in one of his most powerful speeches to the Irish Confederation in Dublin on the 15th of March, 1858, in which he declared, quote, "The survivors of the famine and pestilence have fled to the seacoast and embarked for America, with disease festering in their blood. They have lost sight of Ireland, and the ships that bore them have become sailing coffins and carried them to a new world indeed, not to America, but to eternity." As Wilson notes, McGee's reference to sailing coffins created a sensation in the Confederation, and before long, the boats that carried famine migrants across the Atlantic became known as coffin ships. In coining the phrase sailing coffins, D'Arcy McGee was also drawing on his experience as an editor of The Nation, which had been publishing headlines such as "To Heller Connacht, to Canada or the Grave," and "Death or Transportation" from almost a year earlier, in April of 1847. And yet, the image of the coffin ship is almost never attributed to D'Arcy McGee. His sailing coffins is a curiously literary construction, a verbal expression with no visual referent. Above all else, the image of the coffin ship is evocative of migrants in peril. This is precisely what is lacking in almost all visual, but not textual, representations of the Irish famine migration. In her groundbreaking study, Commemorating the Irish Famine, Memory and the Monument, Emily Marks Fitzgerald notes that, quote, "Scenes of emigration are more numerous and varied than any other type of famine-related subject pictures, yet they almost never feature migrants in danger." Similarly, Niamh O'Sullivan observes that there's a discrepancy, I'm quoting here, a discrepancy between the images and texts in describing the reality of the emigrant experience. No images match the horror of the written eyewitness accounts. Nevertheless, There is one contemporary painting created in 1847 that does depict the suffering of Irish emigrants and the horror of the coffin ships at the moment of their arrival in the fever sheds of Montreal, Théophile Hamel's Le Typhus. This past year, I've curated an exhibit with Christine Keneally, Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, and the Arnold Bernard Library at Quinnipiac University entitled Saving the Famine Irish, the Grey Nuns, and the Great Hunger. The exhibit features Hamel's painting, Le Typhus, as its centerpiece and its correspondences with eyewitness written accounts of the Grey Nuns and female religious communities that cared for famine emigrants in the city's fever sheds, which can also be found on the Digital Irish Famine Archive that Marguerite had mentioned. One of the objectives of the exhibit is to help internationalize famine studies and expand the parameters of Irish famine visual representations to North America, where Le Typhus is the most important and the first painting on the subject. This morning, I intend to focus on Théophile Hamel and the painting itself, as well as its historical moment of composition. I want to examine the influence of French Romanticism, and especially Theodore Géricault's Raft of the Medusa on Hamel's work, and the aesthetic strategies that he employs to represent the plight of migrants in mortal peril. I also want to place particular emphasis on what the artist himself actually saw as an eyewitness to the suffering of Irish famine emigrants when he arrived in Montreal. More broadly, I want to argue that the popular memory of the coffin ships can be traced to the painting's historical moment of creation as a composite image based on verbal and visual representations of the famine Irish migration to British North America, and especially Montreal, in the month of November 1847. Margaret Corporal and Christopher Cusack have traced this memory to a corpus of 19th century novels in which they argue, and I quote, "The coffin ships facilitated the development of microcosmic Irish imagined communities, functioning as heterotopias where the cultural clashes experienced in the homeland and the pending assimilation in the New World have to be negotiated. I want to extend their analytical framework to a set of composite and disparate eyewitness non-fictional accounts of the Irish famine migration from which the popular image of the coffin ships was comprised." In the mid-19th century, Théophile Hamel was one of Quebec's most successful painters. He was born in 1817 in the town of Sainte-Foy, near Quebec City, and became apprenticed to Quebec's most prominent artist, Antoine Plamondon, at the age of 16. During his early career, Hamel specialized in portraiture and achieved renown for works such as Madame Charles Hilaire Tétu, a painting that is indicative of his early style and technique, in which light is concentrated at the level of the face for majestic effect, while a window suggests a landscape beyond, although art historian Raymond Vezina contends that the tasseled hangings make, quote, an insipid backdrop. In 1843, Hamel embarked on a three-year grand tour of Italy, Belgium, and France, where he made sketches of Géricault's Raft of the Medusa or copied it from an etching. Hamel then returned to Quebec City in August 1846 and remained there for little over a year before moving to Montreal in the late autumn of 1847. He thus bore witness to the Irish famine influx during the summer that traversed through both cities, even before he was commissioned to paint Le Typhus by Montreal's Bishop Ignace Bourget on the 13th of August, 1847. Indeed, Bishop Bourget declared, and I quote, "that I will offer a votive offering, a painting representing the typhoid epidemic trying to enter the city, but stopped at its gates by the Virgin Mary's powerful protection." Ironically, on the very same day that he commissioned the painting, the 13th of August, 1847, the bishop himself fell ill with typhus, though he soon recovered. Jacques Desrochers notes, and I quote, "Bishop Bourget's commission became Hamel's first and indeed only work based on a national historic event and on religious life in Montreal. Moreover, it proved to be his one and only commemorative painting." Hamel installed it in the ceiling of the vestibule of Montreal's Notre-Dame de Bon Secours Church, where it can still be seen today. After his completion of Le Typhus in the autumn of 1847, Hamel remained in Montreal for 2 more years before he returned to Quebec City, where his career really flourished. In Montreal, Hamel also painted Dr. Alfred Mayo, one of the physicians, the number of physicians who died during the city's typhus epidemic. He subsequently received commissions for portraits of Canada's leading historical, political, and religious figures, and his copy of The Explorer, Jacques Cartier, was reproduced on dollar bills and stamps and in textbooks. Hamel married Eulalie Antoinette Deneschaux in 1853 and painted several family portraits of his children and nephews and nieces, such as Naomi, Eugenie, Antoinette, and Sephora Hamel, over the course of his career. His celebrated painting, Four Children and a Dog, also of nephews and nieces, was completed in the same year as Le Typhus. Hamel also specialized in portraits of mothers and children, such as Portrait of Madame Caron and her daughter, and Madame David Young, Evêque George, in 1852. By 1856, Hamel was so successful that he was able to lend large sums of money, which further enriched him, proof of his commercial abilities, if perhaps not so much his artistic ones. He was less well known for his religious compositions, though he undertook a number of them, such as Education of the Virgin in 1845, and his portrait of Mother Marie-Rose Eulalie de Rocher on the eve of her death in 1849, which is still highly regarded. Hamel's range of subject matter is considered limited, though he did paint Quebec's indigenous peoples and young Indian girls at Lorette in 1865, albeit in a highly romanticized style. Until his death in 1870, Hamel continued to train some of Quebec's most prominent late 19th century artists, such as Napoleon Bourassa. Ultimately, he's regarded as one of Quebec's most successful painters, and his works are well represented in the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts, the Musée National des Beaux-Arts in Quebec City, and the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa. Nevertheless, Hamel's painting Le Typhus has attracted relatively little interest, in spite of its provenance, as the only eyewitness rendering of the Irish famine migration of 1847, in 1847. Even from this brief overview of his career, it should be obvious that the painting is highly atypical of his artistic output and style. Moreover, it not only expresses his personal observation of the suffering of Irish emigrants, but was inspired by and incorporates figures from Theodore Jericho's Raft of the Medusa, the defining masterpiece of maritime distress. As Jacques Desrochers notes, and I quote, "The sick and the dying in Le Typhus are partly naked, a rarity in Quebec painting. Furthermore, the custom of copying elements of other painters, typical of academic painting, is evident. The two male figures on the extreme right are taken from the famous painting of Géricault. And although it does not measure up to its model, this motif was well chosen to interpret one and the same harsh reality of human misery, but in the Montreal situation, relieved by the help of the religious communities." In tracing Géricault's influence, Hamel's formal incorporation of figures from the Medusa, as well as his scenic composition of distressed migrants, need to be considered. Hamel was inspired by Géricault's depiction of shipwrecked victims in a moment of crisis and his graphic portrayal of death. Géricault had completed The Raft of the Medusa in 1819, 3 years after the ship for which it is named became marooned on a sandbar off the coast of Senegal, and its crew were cast adrift in a ramshackle vessel for 10 days in which they succumbed to cannibalism and murder before they were rescued by the Argus, but only after that ship had disappeared from the horizon and was lost from sight. In his composition of the painting, Géricault famously brought home body parts from the morgue and interviewed the raft's survivors to depict their suffering in extremis. The Raft of the Medusa is often interpreted not only as a harrowing history painting, but also as an allegory about Restoration France, in which the wreck signifies the foundering of the French ship of state after the return of the Bourbon monarchy following Napoleon's defeats in 1814 and 1815, and the appointment of royalist émigrés to positions of influence, such as the Medusa's incompetent captain, responsible for the wreck in the first place. Géricault broke with the conventions of neoclassicism in his choice of subject matter, and emphasis on ordinary mariners and their desperate struggle for survival in place of the plight of their leaders. He was also a founding figure in the development of French Romanticism, which differed significantly from its English and German counterparts. As Jonathan Miles notes, and I quote, "In the powerful northern romantic works of Caspar David Friedrich and J.M.W. Turner, human incident was dramatically subordinated to the force and grandeur of nature. But in Géricault's large painting, however much we feel the presence of threatening elements, the work focuses on the survivors on the raft. Géricault's major painting brings the spectator right up to the action, revealing the artist's early and persistent understanding of the power of the close-up. In the raft, such a procedure insists on the terrifying distance between the seemingly futile agitation of the survivors and the almost imperceptible fleck of the Argus on the horizon. This symbolically asserts the gulf between the peril of the abandoned and the distant attitude of the leaders of the expedition. Indeed, Géricault depicts the very moment in which the survivors are roused by the prospect of rescue while others have succumbed to despair. This tension between the expectation of salvation and the abandonment of hope is at the heart of the painting, the fulcrum of which divides the sailor signaling the ship at the top right from the crouched figure at the bottom left cradling a corpse in a classical posture but with a vacant stare. This survivor seems to suffer more from mental anguish than the physical degradations of the splayed bodies that surround him. He appears curiously detached and disengaged from the action that sweeps the spectator's vision to scan the horizon in search of salvation like the other figures in Géricault's painting. Miles notes that Géricault only added the two corpses at the extreme left and right who bleed out of the frame after he'd finished the image and found the bottom corners disturbingly empty. I only noticed myself when I saw the raft of the Medusa 2 weeks ago in the Louvre that the raft itself is much larger than it first appears, and that it too bleeds out of the frame in the left middle background. What makes this image preternaturally topical is that it captures the moment when most ramshackle vessels capsize as their passengers suddenly shift to one side of the deck in anticipation of rescue, as has occurred countless times in the past year. Most recently, the raft of the Medusa has been adapted into a wall mural by Banksy in Calais, along with his portrait of Steve Jobs as a refugee. Works of art that the town of Calais moved to protect within 24 hours of their discovery last December, while hundreds of unaccompanied children were left to fend for themselves, as they still are. Yet as the raft's crew lurched to the right to gain the attention of the Argus, the only living figure left in the bottom of the frame looks almost crazily composed, despite the commotion that surrounds him, utterly indifferent to his fate. This figure of despair is precisely the one that Théophile Hamel incorporates into Le Typhus. In his description of the painting, Jacques Desrochers notes, and I quote, "In the upper level, the Blessed Virgin in the clouds is separated from the temporal world below. Depicted diagonally," let's go back to the full painting. "Depicted diagonally from foreground to background, are a grey nun, a sister of Providence, and a priest administering the last rites to a dying person with the help of a Hotel Dieu nun. In the background, between the St. Lawrence River and Mount Royal, are the city and the bell towers of Notre Dame Cathedral. The view from this perspective and the presence of a shed places the scene in its original setting. Thus, the axis of the image draws the viewer from the figure of the Virgin Mary to the despondent survivor that Hamel copied from Géricault in the bottom right. Elsewhere, I've noted that Le Typhus is not simply a commemorative image, but also a medium of intercession, in which the bishop summons the Virgin Mary to halt the typhus epidemic from entering the city under her powerful protection. I want to further suggest that the typhus is portrayed quite literally in the painting, as the Virgin Mary appears not only perched on billowing clouds, but also appears to block the miasma and vaporous fumes that were mistakenly believed to be the cause of the disease from spreading into the city. The tension in the image is defined by this line, a vision from the Virgin to Jericho's despondent figure clutching a corpse. As in the raft of the Medusa, he seems oblivious to his surroundings and utterly indifferent to his fate. Beyond rescue and the reach of the female religious sisters who provide succor and the prospect of salvation. He is crouched in a classical posture, but appears an embodiment of the abandonment of hope. Also like in Jericho's painting, he seems already to have joined the ranks of the dead, whose scattered bodies and limbs lie haphazardly amongst the living. Indeed, Hamel's scenic composition of clustered living and dead bodies thronged together in a seething mass and close-up portrayal of their mental anguish and physical suffering is directly influenced by Jericho, who gave Hamel artistic license to envision this moment of crisis as a harrowing mortuary spectacle that he had personally witnessed. More broadly, Hamel's painting provides a composite image of the crowd in motion, a montage of the huddled mass of typhus victims who arrived in Montreal's fever sheds throughout the summer of 1847. It is a composite image in the sense that its scenic composition is diachronic rather than synchronic. The three orders of nuns depicted in the painting never stood alongside one another, but rather worked in succession to care for fever victims whilst their ranks were thinned by the same affliction. In a more fundamental sense, the typhus also encapsulates a form of tension between the face of the individual migrant and the image of the crowd in motion, one that would become a recurrent feature of refugee portraiture and visual representations of mass migration in the years that followed. Indeed, this tension between the face and what Lisa Malke terms the anonymous corporeality of the crowd is inherent in any depiction of mass displacement. It creates the aesthetic challenge of how to individuate a large-scale and overwhelming event, to render the individual experience while retaining a focus on its collective nature without losing sight of either of them. At first glance, it might seem that this tension can be resolved by focusing on the face of the individual migrant, emphasizing the solitary figure within the crowd in motion. But Hamel's incorporation of Jericho's despondent survivor provides a salutary reminder that the individual migrant is no less anonymous or meaningful a signifier of traumatic upheaval than images of huddled masses. He is but an arrested figure abstracted from the totality of migrants on the move. The sheer blankness of his expression also negates any impression that he can make comprehensible their plight. His eyes provide no window into the soul. They stare blankly into space, devoid of consolation or insight. This image of mental anguish also complements the most compelling verbal descriptions of the coffin ships. Théophile Hamel's painting Le Typhus was not only influenced by Jericho, but is also an eyewitness rendering event that he had personally seen. As I've noted, Hamel moved to Montreal in the autumn of 1847, when fewer vessels were arriving from Ireland, but mortality rates in the city's fever sheds remained very high. More significantly, he was in Montreal in November of 1847, when the last of the coffin ships reached Quebec and New Brunswick with former tenants from Lord Palmerston's estate in Sligo, such as the Richard Watson and the Lord Ashburton, on which over 100 migrants had died. The last of the coffin ships caused public outrage and press indignation in British North America. They also provided a catalyst for Passenger Act reform. Tyler Anbinder and Desmond Morton have examined the Palmerston assisted emigration scheme in detail, but neither has fully considered its press coverage and impact on public opinion. In particular, two letters from Stephen Devere in Toronto on the 30th of November and Adam Ferry in Montreal on the 1st of December influenced British parliamentarians into legislating Passenger Act reform. Both letters emphasised the spectacle of huddled, poorly clad and mentally disturbed migrants that is reproduced in Théophile Hamel's painting, verbal and visual images which emanate from the same historical moment. The genealogy of the coffin ship motif can be traced not only to D'Arcy McGee's sailing coffins, but also these composite sources that record the late arrivals of transatlantic vessels from Lord Palmerston's estate in November 1847. Théophile Hamel bore witness to these events in Montreal's fever sheds that autumn. Although his painting, Le Typhus, is a composite image of the suffering of famine Irish emigrants and the care they received over the summer, its scenic composition most closely resembles what he actually saw as an eyewitness impression. On the 26th of September 1847, the Grey Nuns in the foreground of the painting had returned to tend to fever victims after they'd retreated from the sheds for 2 months in order to convalesce. They also record in their annals what transpired in the sheds under their watch. In their own words, they recall, and I quote, "Seeing carts filled with coffins slowly passing in the direction of the cemeteries in the early hours of the morning, we still see the massive tombs prepared daily to receive new victims. Death lingered continually over the ambulances like an imprisoned shadow enveloping all those who dared to penetrate it." More significantly, the Grey Nuns also register the moment of arrival of the last of the coffin ships and their dying passengers on steamers in Montreal. According to the Annal, and I quote, "It was November 24th at 11 o'clock in the evening. A steamboat charged with 300 sick came from Gros Isle arriving in the port. We sent as many vehicles as we could procure, and the doctors directed themselves at the same time with stretchers to help transport the sick. When we saw the disembarkation of the ship, we realized that more than 80 had died during the voyage, which meant that nurses passed a great part of the night transporting the cadavers that had been placed in the shed where their bodies were kept until the following day, when they would be brought to the cemetery. These poor unfortunates arrived in a state difficult to describe. Nature and the elements seemed to be mourning these poor victims. A torrential rain was falling, thunder was groaning with fury, and in the midst of this terrible noise, we heard the cries and groans of the sick, who, thrown about pell-mell and not being able to support the jolting of transport, gracefully asked to be placed in the bad weather shelter in order to expire in peace. Finally, we were able to place these poor sick in their designated sheds." This frenetic scene, recalled by the Grey Nuns, is defined by the sudden arrival of a mass of stricken emigrants huddled together amongst the dead and the living. The chaotic impression of scattered bodies and the cries and groans of the sick and dying thrown about pell-mell lends both the Annal and Hamel's painting a heightened sense of crisis. Indeed, the crepuscular setting of the painting that shades from darkness into light seems to frame this harrowing image of distressed emigrants at night. The spectacle is largely corroborated by press accounts of the sudden appearance of the last of the coffin ships. There are some discrepancies between the religious annals and newspaper reports about the numbers of emigrant casualties and the dates of their arrival in port. In fact, the Lord Ashburton and Richard Watson reached Quebec and Montreal earlier than the Grey Nuns recalled in the first week of November following the closure of the quarantine station at Gros Isle. The lateness of the season, the poor condition and clothing of the emigrants, and the sheer numbers of widows and orphans led to considerable press censure. Shortly after the arrival of the Richard Watson, the Quebec Mercury reported, and I quote, "These poor creatures from Lord Palmerston's estate had become almost a byword for wretchedness. They were penniless and in rags, without shoes or stockings, and laying upon bare boards, not even having straw. These poor children, infants, were sitting on the bare deck, perfectly naked and huddled together shivering, the mother a widow and in rags." According to the Montreal Herald, I quote, "Probably there are few cases on record with such wholesale sickness and suffering as have been experienced as among the immigrants of 1847. How was it with the Lord Ashburton, with its 470 souls? 120 died before they reached Montreal, although all dispatch was used in forwarding them on from Quebec. And one quarter more went into hospital before 3 days after landing here. Probably not one half of the whole number were living to usher in the new year. The Irish press was no less scathing than Canadian newspapers when the wretched condition of the passengers was made public. Quote, a large portion of those Irish slaves were captured on the lands of Lord Palmerston, mocked the Cork Examiner. And quote, from disfiguring the classic fields of Sligo, were sent to a fitting death in the fever sheds of Canada. Quote, and this Lord Palmerston is one of the ministry who have declared as their maxim that the property of Ireland must support the poverty of Ireland, ridiculed the Dublin Weekly Nation. Ultimately, the arrivals of the Lord Ashburton and Richard Watson so late in the season and the conspicuous destitution of their passengers engendered strong press reaction and public indignation on both sides of the Atlantic. These press accounts, however, had little impact in and of themselves on government policy. Much more influential were two letters sent by Adam Ferry and Stephen de Vere to Earl Grey, Secretary of the Colonies, within 24 hours of one another at the end of November 1847, which were both subsequently published. Adam Ferry was a member of the Canadian Legislative Council and chairman of Montreal's Emigrant Committee. On December 1st, he published an open letter to Earl Grey, bitterly condemning the Irish landlords, such as Lord Palmerston and Major Mahon, and their agents for endangering emigrants that was prompted by the arrival of the Lord Ashburton and Richard Watson in the city. Quote, in many instances, from 600 to 800 were huddled together in one indiscriminate mass, he wrote, being double the number the vessels were capable of accommodating with any degree of comfort or safety, akin to the vile and heartless traffic of the slave trade. Like much of the press, Ferry singled out for particularly opprobrium, quote, the last cargo of human beings which was received from Lord Palmerston's estate by the Lord Ashburton, the captain of which but a few days since has died of the prevailing fever, and consisted in all of 174 men, women, and youths, of which 87 were almost in a state of nudity. In his emphasis on desperate and dying, poorly clad emigrants huddled together in an indiscriminate mass, Adam Ferry supplies much of the imagery of the coffin ships that was reproduced in press accounts and Hamel's paintings, and indeed the press quoted him directly early in 1848. He also stresses the mental anguish more than the physical suffering of fever patients. Quote, the remnants now scattered over various portions of the province have become dispirited in mind and in many instances utterly reckless of their future condition and fortunes, he claims. Their psychological distress, disorientation, and indifference to their fate are accentuated by Ferry as symptoms of poor maritime regulation and landlord neglect. 24 hours earlier, Stephen de Vere also sent a letter from Toronto describing the harrowing conditions of the coffin ships that would also shock British parliamentarians into implementing Passenger Act reform. His decision to accompany tenants from his estate at Kirk Chase in County Limerick in the steerage of a transatlantic vessel gave him a unique eyewitness perspective on the dangers they faced. The letter that he wrote on the 30th of November, 1847, was read aloud by Earl Grey in the House of Lords and still provides by far the most influential and widely cited description of the common ships. It's been read countless times, so I'll read it again. Before the emigrant has been a week at sea, he is an altered man. How can it be otherwise? Hundreds of poor people, men, women, and children of all ages, from the driveling idiot of 90 to the babe just born, huddled together, without light, without air, wallowing in filth, and breathing in a fetid atmosphere. Sick in body and dispirited at heart, the fevered patients lying between the Sound and sleeping places so narrow as almost to deny them the power of indulging, by a change in position, the natural restlessness of the disease. By their agonized ravings, disturbing those around them and predisposing them through the effects of the imagination to imbibe the contagion. Living without food or medical help except as administered by the hand of casual charity, dying without the voice or spiritual consolation, and buried in the deep without the rites of the church. Like Adam Ferry, Stephen De Vere foregrounds the mental angst of Irish emigrants more than their physical torments. His altered man, prone to agonizing ravings and dispirited at heart, bears a close resemblance to Ferry's scattered migrants, dispirited in mind, as well as Hamel's despondent survivor, so influenced by Jericho. They are cognate figures under psychological pressure, composite images of mental distress. They display apathetic, despondent, and vacant faces amidst the crowd in motion, epitomize the traumatic upheaval of the mind mid-journey or at journey's end. Indeed, Stephen De Vere contends that the migrant's mental disturbance predisposes them through the effects of the imagination to imbibe the contagion. The deterioration of the psyche precedes the body's collapse. This has become the most influential image of the coffin ship and was instrumental in shaping policy, though its provenance remains little known. In his classic study entitled A Pattern of Government Growth, The Passenger Acts and Their Enforcement, Oliver McDonough contends that Stephen De Vere's letter, quote, made a profound impression on the commissioners. It is scarcely too much to regard it as the basis of most of the legislation for of most of their future legislation for ship life. McDonough's claim appears all the more remarkable given his broader argument that incremental measures, rather than motivated individuals, influenced the regulation of the emigrant trade and passenger vessels that involved, in one way or another, a most important range of forces which brought, in McDonough's view, the early modern state into existence. Quote, no organized pressure group concerned itself with the safeguarding of voluntary emigration, McDonough contends. No political party or parliamentary interest took it up. Nevertheless, Stephen De Vere's harrowing description of the coffin ships was the exception that proved the rule. His famous letter read aloud in the House of Lords can be traced to his unpublished diary entries and letters he wrote during the transatlantic voyage after his arrival in Canada. On the 20th of February 1847, De Vere declared his intention to, quote, emigrate to Upper Canada about the middle of April, taking with me some of my people, pauperized by the loss of the potato crop. It was not until he had witnessed the suffering of Irish emigrants at sea, in the fever sheds of Grosse Ile, Montreal, and Toronto, however, that he began to write his letter in July of 1847. In his journal entry on the 19th of July, De Vere notes that, quote, wrote a paper describing the treatment of passengers on board emigrant ships with sundry suggestions for ensuring better arrangements. He does not complete his letter, however, until the month of November, after the press uproar from the last of the coffin ships. On the 30th of November, he records, quote, preparing dispatch, and then, quote, dispatch my letter the following day. 2 months later, on the 12th of February, 1848, De Vere notes with satisfaction, and I quote, a report of a public meeting in Toronto adopting almost verbatim my views as to the necessity of improvement in the emigration system. Thus, I have the satisfaction of finding my opinion supported by the Canadian public and at the same time likely to be adopted by the English ministry. Indeed, the very moment his impressions of the coffin ships began to shape government policy was recorded in a letter on January 31st, 1848, from Elliot Warburton to De Vere's younger brother, the Victorian poet Aubrey De Vere. Quote, I was at the Colonial Office on Saturday, where I found its secretary in raptures, he wrote, about a letter he had received from Stephen. He said it was just what he wanted in stating his experience in his brave enterprise of emigrating as a pauper. He had made the dumb to speak. In emigrating as a pauper and ostensibly giving the dumb a voice to speak, Stephen De Vere defined the lasting image of the coffin ship and helped shape future legislation for emigrant protection. Although he could not actually speak for the subaltern, as we put it now, De Vere registered the predicament of migrants in transit that led to a change in policy. Ultimately, though, he was dismayed that the legislation he inspired increased levies for emigrant ships that undermined the passenger trade he had sought to safeguard. His verbal image of migrants in peril helped shape policy, but inadvertently closed off avenues of escape from Ireland. In conclusion, De Vere envisioned the mentally anguished, altered man whose traits attest to the harrowing conditions on the coffin ships. These traits were formed from a wide array of composite sources, such as the deathly imprisoned shadows of the Grey Nun's annals, contemporary press accounts, the eyewitness testimonials of De Vere and Ferry, and Hamel's painting, which began to take shape in the fever sheds of Montreal in November of 1847. The cultural memory of the coffin ships was, of course, a cumulative response to the Irish famine migration as a whole. But the eyewitness testimonials that influenced policy were also personal reactions to specific events in the autumn of that year. What had initially seemed like a migrant emergency became increasingly perceived as an abdication of responsibility by Irish landlords and British legislators at year's end, at least in the eyes of those influential, politically connected letter writers like Adam Ferry and Stephen De Vere. Moreover, De Vere's impressions of migrant breakdowns foreshadow countless future images of isolated figures amidst refugee flows. In tracing Jericho's influence on Hamel, his figure of this despondent survivor more readily bridges the divide between visual and verbal representations of the Irish famine migration than any other image from 1847. He appears anomalous in both The Raft of the Medusa and Le Typhus, a stranded migrant who stares into space, a presentiment of our time. His predicament is that of forced migrants past and present, the involuntarily displaced who succumb to despair, like De Vere's altered man. This image of the despondent survivor in Le Typhus is held in tension with the Virgin's saving grace and the prospect of physical rescue and salvation from the three orders of French Canadian nuns who remove Irish infants from the breasts of their stricken mothers, the ultimate act of cultural transfer. Elsewhere, I've examined the legacy of these Irish famine orphan adoptions in considerable depth. Their stories continued to resonate in the late 19th century in the works of John Talbot Smith, for example, who invokes the memory of famine orphan Mary Cassidy to resolve tension between French-Canadian and Irish Catholic families in Connecticut, who are bitterly opposed to the intermarriage of their offspring until the French protagonist's Irish ancestry is revealed. Quote, "It was truly the canonization of Mary Cassidy," the story concludes, "a subject worthy of a great painter." This apotheosis of the famine orphan in memory installs her in place of the Virgin Mary in Hamel's painting, presiding over a moment of reconciliation between French Canadians and Irish Catholics in the same spirit of the infant orphan adoptions decades earlier. Yet, it is an image held in tension with Hamel's depiction of the despondent survivor, a harrowing figure influenced by Jericho, whose blank and vacant expression attests to the traumatic circumstances of the Irish famine migration and its visual legacy. This conference gives us the opportunity to re-examine this visual legacy within an expanded purview, to re-envision the Irish famine migration as a mid-Victorian refugee crisis. Thank you.
Hi, Jason. Can I ask you, I'm very interested in this connection between Stephen De Vere and Aubrey De Vere, because, of course, Aubrey De Vere writes a really significant poem related to the famine, indeed, the Year of Sorrow in 1848, which actually then inspires the Watts painting. So to what extent were they, do you have any sense of, were they in correspondence over having a shared interest in the famine necessarily in terms of inspiring reform and whatnot?
Yes, they were in very close correspondence throughout 1847 and 1848 when Stephen De Vere went to Canada. His initial plan, as I mentioned, was he wanted to basically experiment with the idea of colonization and create a model which he thought would then be replicated by many others and that the British government would fund, where he would take out a small group of tenants from his estate and Kirk Chase, help them resettle in Canada, hope that they would become quickly successful and others would follow in their footsteps. Or at least that was his stated motive for going abroad. He also, like many people at that time, was flirting with the idea of converting to Catholicism, but was terrified of his mother. And so it wasn't until he actually went abroad that he converted formally, went to Mass for the first time, Catholic Mass in Montreal, and then told Aubrey and his other brothers to tell their mother because he wanted to find out how she would respond. And much of his diary, much of his unpublished diary, is concerned with his angst as he doesn't get a reply for months and months. And when he finally does get a response from Aubrey, it's simply to say, oh, I haven't told her yet. And it makes him quite upset. Ultimately, she did accept his conversion. His colonization scheme was, for the most part, a failure. It really didn't work out as he had anticipated. And he came back to Canada in the middle of 1848. But while he was in Canada, he also received warnings from Aubrey in particular after the April Uprising broke out not to come back. Stephen de Vere was more sympathetic to people like William Smith O'Brien and others. And the sense was that if he came back now, it would simply be causing a lot of trouble, getting himself into trouble. So they kept telling him, stay longer in Canada. And what you get in both of the letters, but really more so from Stephen de Vere to Aubrey de Vere, are very detailed descriptions, not only of the impact of the famine in Canada, but also it's a wonderful travelogue with vivid descriptions of the flora and the fauna of British North America, de Vere's various adventures when he goes out shooting squirrels and things like that, a four-page description of Niagara Falls when he goes to visit it. But to render the answer short, yes, there's very extended correspondence between them.
Actually, if I can take the opportunity to just ask you one more question. Do you know anything in terms of the display history of that painting? Because I've seen it in the church, and it's actually extremely hard to see.
Indeed.
And I'm just curious as to, was there any other aspect of public exhibition, or was it always intended to simply be placed at that kind of very, you know, high point in the church where it is now?
Yeah, it's never been moved since its completion.
Can I ask, thank you very much about this painting and the despondent survivor and all that, but what about the woman in the center? Where she is... the woman who's...
This woman.
That woman.
Well...
Is this... I mean, she's the thing I see first.
Yes.
Have you got a take on where she... What she... I mean, does she come from something, or is it a...
Yeah, I mean, the sort of the primary meaning of the painting, you might say, is these acts of...
But, is there a Jerichoian influence there?
No.
No.
The only Jerichoian influence is this figure.
Okay, so... Yeah, but I suppose that I myself would look at that woman first, and I just would like to know more about her and how she fits in with the aesthetic creation of a famine scenario, if there is one.
I
would be curious to know,
There are figures in the painting we can individuate and record the moment in which Hamel decided this is a motif that should go into the image. Mm-hmm. In particular, this man cradling his wife in the background is one I found a newspaper account for.
Okay.
The husband cradling his dead wife. But for the most part, the figures in the foreground here, I would say, are generic images.
Yes. Yeah.
This is the famine.
So you would say the picture has more generic elements than necessarily a...
Yes.
19th century historical...
Well, I made the point, it's a composite image. The three orders of nuns never work together. He's recording separate moments in time over the course of the summer of 1847. And by the same token, the victims he's recording came at different moments over the course of that summer. So this is not a woman I think we could individuate with any specificity. In terms of the conventions of the portraiture, I think we would find it in his other images from the period. But in terms of what's actually happening in the painting, it's the verbal correspondences we have to go to, the annals of the Grey Nuns in particular, where again and again there's these vignettes, these scenes of nuns removing children from their mothers who are dying and taking care of these children in the weeks and months that followed, presiding over their adoptions months later. And that's really, I think, what's going on in the bottom foreground here.
It's just that, the hovering virgin on the clouds, that's like 400 years of religious painting from there.
Mm-hmm.
So the compositeness is... It's actually a kind of a mix of rather conservative and quite contemporary. Well, relatively contemporary.
Jason, it's actually in relation to a question Fintan's just been asking, because especially has to do, again, I think, with this female figure that is so central to the painting. I was also wondering if we think in terms of visual repertoires available to Hamel when he made the painting, to what extent he was also really influenced, you could say, by the imagery, for instance, that was printed in the Illustrated London News and other kinds of papers that sort of depicted a very strong feminized or gendered version of famine as well. Do you happen to know anything about that?
Yeah, I'd be pretty confident he never read the Illustrated London News. Hamel is, of course, a French painter. And perhaps more importantly, all of the images of the Illustrated London News concerning emigration come from later, say 1848, 1849, 1850. There are, as far as I know, no images of migrants in transit in the Illustrated London News in 1847, at least that I've seen. And again, the traditions he's working with, I think are more, some of the images I showed of mothers painted with children, it's part of his stock repertoire, so he's done a lot of work like that. And the there's a tradition of painting of votive images in Quebec in particular, anonymous popular votive images that would be somewhat similar to that, where I think he's working out of that tradition as well. But, Hamel isn't influenced by any existing genre of famine art, because he doesn't have access to it, and of course his experience of the famine is limited to these fever sheds in this moment in time, in the summer and autumn of 1847. For Hamel scholars, this is not a particularly important painting. The famine is not a particularly important event in Hamel's life. This painting doesn't tend to get mentioned in art historical studies of Hamel's work.
Jason, the picture you've given us is a very benign one of religious philanthropy manifest in the Hamel painting and kind of more secular philanthropy through the interventions by De Vere and Ferry. But so much of the public discourse generated by the arrival, particularly the late 1847 arrival of assisted immigrants in the Canadian ports is negative. It's protectionist.
That's right.
It's demanding not just, reform of the Passenger Acts, but it's demanding Canadian legislation to increase the ticket prices, to price the poverty stricken out of the immigration trade. So, are you seeing? I mean, it seems to be a kind of disjuncture between the kind of manifestations that you've shown us and the perhaps dominant tone in the Canadian press in response to the immigrant flow in 1847.
Yeah, I would respond to that in two ways. It's perhaps on the surface a benign image, but a point I've made elsewhere, it's very much not a benign image in the sense that there's certainly a lot of public uproar over the arrival of famine immigrants, but there's also a lot of religious antagonism, and encoded in that image is the idea of Catholic clergy, Catholic nuns saving Irish immigrants, where there's in reality a kind of competition going on between Catholic and Protestant religious organizations to save their own and to prevent them from becoming converted to the other side. And that's very much present in the annals of the Grey Nuns and the written accounts. It's implicit in the image, but not something I focused on today. With respect to your latter point, I certainly would agree with you. The clamor that led to the increasing of levies on passenger ships all comes out of the arrival of famine immigrants, but doesn't really crystallize, and this is the point I was making in my paper, it doesn't really crystallize till the end of the autumn, and doesn't really crystallize until, as I said, politically connected individuals start to write those letters, like Adam Ferry, like Stephen De Vere, who are supportive in principle of continued emigration, but want to see much better conditions on ships. And in Stephen De Vere's case, you can see in his diaries and his letters in particular, increasing anxiety as he realizes that his plan has almost backfired. His letter has been very influential, but now as the talk about increasing those levies, as has already happened in the United States, gathers steam, De Vere becomes increasingly mocking of Earl Grey in particular, saying he's got it all wrong, he's going to devastate the passenger trade, this isn't going to solve anything, it's simply going to prevent people from coming, which is exactly what happened. And yes, of course, that's linked to the public anxiety, the clamor that happens really towards the end of the autumn, where of course, the mortality rates are higher during the summer, but it takes a while, I think, for the effect of that to sink in. And it's, I think, in particular, the very late arrival of those ships and the very destitute appearance of those emigrants after there's been a break for a few weeks, when the weather is significantly deteriorated, that's the kind of final straw. And it's a point you see in the state papers for Stuart and Kincaid, you know, the agents who weren't, of course, planning to send people in such miserable conditions acknowledged. They simply hadn't realized the severity of the climate changes over the course of the summer. And it's that which leads to the ultimately to the changes in passenger rates.
It's the same dynamic in New Brunswick as well.
Indeed.
The late arrival of the ships
Aelis
in November.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of tips things over the edge.
And it's Lord Palmerston again. It's those late arriving ships that sort of changes the dynamic. And it's that's when the painting is created too. I guess that's the other point I want to make. That's when Hamel is there in the sheds. You know, of course, it's a composite image. He's recording what happens over the course of the summer. But when he's actually in the sheds creating the painting, the only significant event is the arrival of those Palmerston ships, which is why they also stand out in the Grey Nun accounts.
All right, I think we have to leave it at this, if you don't mind. May I ask for one big applause for Jason for his fantastic opening keynote?